Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A clear blue sky. That's the way we remember it. And from that sky, 10 years ago Sunday, the airplanes, the attacks that astounded the world. And now, a decade has gone by with so much history, and so much history that hinged off 9/11. Today, now, in our last hour on the air before the 10th anniversary, we just want to talk with you about what you've seen and learned and experienced in these 10 years. This hour on Point 9/11 and all that came after, Jack Beatty is here, and we're opening the phone lines to you. What image, what moment first comes to mind when you remember that day, and what have we learned since 9/11? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 3 days after the attack, September 14th, 2001, President Bush picked up the megaphone and addressed the rescue workers at Ground Zero.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... We'll hear all of us soon.
The tragedy, the loss, the fateful emotion, you can hear it all right there. Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, thank you for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
We've got so much response coming in already, Jack. Let me go straight to one here. This is from Toyota today, just writing into us this morning. Even now, when I see the photos or hear sound clips from 9/11, I struggle to hold back the tears. I'm brought vividly back to that clear, wonderfully beautiful blue September and the enjoyable commute I had to work. I got in and out of the subway thinking of how gorgeous the weather was. That's how I remember 9/11. The weather was so peaceful and the sky was so vast compared to the frantic chaos and the cringing fighter jet screams. And we're right back there, Jack.
Oh, yes, and those fighter jet screams. We were talking this morning, and you remembered their noise, that afterburner that you could hear. Now, Tom, you were in Lower Manhattan on that day.
No, actually, I was supposed to be. I never made it there. I was driving with a friend into Manhattan. We had two meetings scheduled that day, one in Lower Manhattan that morning, but earlier in the morning on the way down, was driving through Connecticut and got a call from my wife on the cell phone. Just as we were pulling into the parking lot for our first stop there, she said, turn on the radio. I did. I didn't really understand what I was hearing. We went in for our appointment there. There was nobody at the front desk. We walked all the way back and hello, and found everybody in that office, gathered in a back room looking out over the Tidal Flats there, television up on the boardroom table, whatever it was, and everybody just dumbstruck, staring at the television. We walked in just as that second plane hit the tower. And then just sat transfixed, as people did all over the country and around the world, you know, for those next long, unbelievable, reality-defying minutes until it came down in that great mushroom, horrible, horrible collapse to the ground. And there we were. I did not drive on to Lower Manhattan that day, but it was unforgettable, as so many people. But then, Jack, I think... from our conversations, remembering back, I mean, the initial serendipity of it, the initial unlikelihood of it, was kind of what marked your morning.
Well, yes. We had just moved in here. We didn't have our television on.
You're up there in New Hampshire, just over that beautiful ridge from the Connecticut River in your...
That's right.
In your wooded enclave there.
Yes, and we were in a wooded enclave of the mind, in a way. I turned on the radio, heard Bob Edwards say, a plane has hit the World Trade Center, and I thought, well, that's a Piper Club. And I turned off the radio and went back to my tasks. And it wasn't until later in the afternoon when the television was connected up and we turned it on to see if it was working that there it was. And it was like we were living in Shangri-La up here. We just couldn't believe. And we had the phone hadn't been connected. It was a series of things. But suddenly there it was. Yeah, the moment.
Jack, I want to go back. I mean, this is also a kind of 10-year anniversary coming up for us. It was just a few years after 9/11. NPR called WBUR here in Boston to say that people had been working 24 hours a day. They needed fresh horses. There was a meeting here. And the next day, you and I were on the air. Here's a little tape from way back then. This was September 19th. And we talked with you about how the country might change as a result of this. You said it had already, only that few days later, changed in ways that we couldn't have imagined here from September 19th, 2001. Jack and I.
You've already given a good anecdote illustrative of that, and that is the young woman in New York who says she's never going to wear high heels again. She's going to wear shoes she can run in. If that's the sort of the bottom of it, the top of it is our whole idea of the skyscraper, once a vaunting symbol of American power, to now is a symbol of vulnerability. According to the Wall Street Journal, executive search firms now, their clients are saying, well, we don't want to work in high buildings. This is a revolution in American sensibility. You can look at American history as a kind of resistance, a conspiracy almost, against the idea of vulnerability. Mm. We're Americans.
We don't want to feel that.
That's right. And this is, we have no psychological paradigm to process this and no cultural one either. So we are in a new territory. We had an experience with terror during the Cold War, with the nuclear threat, but that was
yep.
critically different. The phrase of the day was a balance of terror. The assumption was the enemy wanted to live, and that basic human commonality with the Soviet Union and pretty much exclusively kept the peace. They didn't want to die. We don't want to die. Well, we have now an imbalance of terror dealing with opponents who can't be deterred by the thought of losing their life. And that is literally a terrifying threat.
Jack Beatty and a little bit of myself there nearly 10 years ago, September 19th, 2001, just days after the planes hit the tower and the world began to take on board. And right there, Jack, you called it right away. There was no psychological paradigm to process this. And there was no balance of terror that we pretty quickly moved to one way or another, attempt to create one. We're opening the phone lines this hour to talk with you about your memories of that day and about what we have learned since 9/11. Jack, let's bring our listeners right in. They've been such constant and steady friends and teachers through all these years. Denise in Nashville, Tennessee, thank you for calling. Denise, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was actually a commodity trader. I was in Singapore for a conference on 9/11. We walked back into the hotel from our last business dinner and heard these crazy stories of things that were happening, and it was unbelievable. I was literally with New Yorkers. I was with people I traded with every day and talked to on the phone every day who couldn't reach their spouses, people who worked with folks in those buildings. You know, I knew people who worked there.
Mm-hmm.
And this, we talked about the fact that this would be a date that split time, that we would refer to things before and after 9/11. I literally flew over in business class with silverware and flew back with plastic knives and forks.
Yeah.
And in my own life,
yes.
Crazy enough, after sitting up all night watching coverage, after a couple hours of sleep, my husband and I looked at each other when we woke up and said, do we need to have children? I was a 36-year-old professional career woman traveling around the world enjoying my job, and this really made us think about what we were investing in and what we were spending our life doing. And it took us a couple years, but I have two basically 9/11 babies who both have severe autism, and now I'm a stay-at-home autism mom. My life could not be more different because of the events of 9/11.
So it was a date that split time for you, Denise.
It absolutely was.
I appreciate your call. Jack, she flew out to Singapore with steel cutlery and came back with plastic and just one of the millions and millions of ways in which life has changed. Babies born, the impulse to make life right there. But what about the split in time? Do you look on it now, Jack? Was it the split in time we thought it would be? I think it is, but I'm not. It's a more nuanced understanding of that phrase now than we had then.
I think that's right. I mean, there's been so much in the interim between us and then. It's hard to know whether the future is going to be as connected to that as the immediate past was. We may have overstated how it was going to affect us. I remember someone writing, "It's the end of irony." Well, irony made a comeback.
Yes.
Thank heaven, too. I mean, Americans learn to laugh and to make fun of things. But what hasn't changed, and what we're reminded of, even as we go on the air, when there's a vague terror threat this weekend,
maybe in a tunnel, maybe on a bridge,
yes,
New York, Washington,
is that this is an open-ended conflict, or whatever you want to call it, with Al Qaeda, with terrorism, and there's going to be no ceremony on the Missouri ending it. And that in that way, it has been an inflection point, a moment that split time, because we haven't faced anything like that in this country, a threat that can't be ended in the American way with overwhelming force and power, which is the American military tradition. This isn't that. We're facing something very different.
And yet, Jack, at this point, 10 years later, I feel so resistant to being a prisoner of that anymore. It may be a reality we can't change, but I don't want in myself, and I hope as a country, to only be living in response to that anymore.
No, and I think people feel that strongly. In fact, remember right after the attack, people would say, you know, the terrorists will win unless I show that I can, you know, spend money or do
things. I don't mean go shopping, you know.
No,
it's something deeper, something bigger than that. We'll look at it. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's our last show before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks comes Sunday. I'm here with On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. We're opening up the phone lines this hour and looking back on these last 10 years with you on 9/11 and all that came after and where we are now. You can join the conversation this hour. How do you look back at 9/11 now and what it meant? What have you learned? Did it change you? Did it change us? How do we go from that national unity to now the division? What's important to say about 9/11 here nearly 10 years later? Just to keep the feeling, the sound of that time in our ears, here's a little excerpt of a montage that we ran then. Back then, On Point was called Special Coverage for NPR. This was October 12th, 2001. This is 1 month after 9/11.
I do want to thank the folks here at Booker Elementary School for their hospitality. Today, we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country. Let's look in the North Pole quickly, quickly.
Be coming down.
Oh my God.
The second tower.
I really have to commend them. If you really want to know what New Yorkers were all about, you just watch the way in which they handled themselves. They didn't panic. They moved deliberately. They moved swiftly. But they didn't hurt each other. They helped each other. I mean, these are just the most wonderful people in the world.
Taliban must act and act immediately. They will hand over the terrorists or they will share in their fate.
And back we go on the time machine to 1 month after that day. George Bush there, Rudy Giuliani, a news reporter saying that's the North Tower that seems to be coming down. What's important to say about 9/11 now, about the day, the loss, the response, these years? 800-423-8255. Jack, let's go to our phones. Marjorie in Milton, Massachusetts. Marjorie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I was in France on a bicycle trip, and when I came into the hotel, the small inn where I was staying, about 6 o'clock at night, everybody looked at me and realized that I was an American and said, "Did you hear the news?" And they made sure that I saw the TV and saw all the news. that night I was in supper with by myself, because I was traveling by myself, mm-hmm. and a table of English and Germans beckoned me over, and one of them had lost a friend in the tower. One of the Germans had lost a dear friend in from the tower, and they just couldn't have been more sympathetic. And the next day was Sunday, and I had not seen the local church in the little hill town where I was, so I thought, well, I'd like to just look in and see it. I knew there was a service going on Sunday morning, but I just wanted to look in and see it, so I opened the door very gently. And at that moment, just by sheer chance, I heard three women sending their sympathies to America on a microphone. They, one after another, sent their sympathies to America.
We all remember that. Was it Le Monde headline, Marjorie and Francine, we're all Americans now? It's been 10 years, Marjorie. What about now? Would you expect that same embrace today?
Well, I think that President Bush turned France against us, and there was a terrible moment when France just absolutely, it was a very, very different story. But at that moment, there was such sympathy, and all of Europe, at 12 o'clock, all of Europe had a moment of silence for the Americans, and it was such a well of sympathy that it really hurt to hear what we were saying about France.
Marjorie, I appreciate your call so much, and thank you for sharing that memory, Jack. It brings to mind, I mean, there was the destruction that the whole world saw, and if you were close enough, smelled it. Pete Hamill writing The New Republic about the fires that burned there for weeks. The air was stained, he writes, with the odor of melting steel, burning wood, burning plaster, burning paper, and the burning fragments of smashed human bodies. And the whole world saw that, Jack, and the scale of it. And you heard the embrace that Marjorie had there, and her and then the relations later with France and so many others, it begins to bring to mind all the might-have-beens out of this decade, the might-have-beens.
Yes.
I don't know what the perfect response would have been, but surely the one we took was only one.
It was one. Yes, and you know, it's almost like a paradise lost in the country. The sense of unity, and more than that, solidarity and fellow feeling that people were showing, that was a kind of high point. And then the international sympathy for us, which immediately started. Both have we've had a sharp decline from both. I see now that according to the Brookings poll, nearly 7 in 10 Americans think the country is less respected in the world today than it was before the attacks, and they're probably right about the world as a whole. We had what could have been different? Well, how could we have handled it in another way? You know, it's probably inevitable that anybody who attacked, that any president would have gone into Afghanistan, and that would have cost us something in the world's esteem, although not much. But let's be clear, it clearly this fall in what the world thought of us and the divisions within our society, even really started with Iraq. If you have to identify the point where the narrative goes off, whether for better or worse, it certainly seems to be there.
We'll come to Iraq. Scotty in Shelby, North Carolina. Scotty, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Scotty. Are you there, my friend?
Yes.
What's your story?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's your story, Scotty?
I have a very special story that's dear to my heart. My wife and I had some serious marriage problems prior to September 11th, and we decided we was going to end our marriage, and we went to get an apartment for one of us to move into. That night, we spent the night together in the apartment. Woke up the next morning, which was September 11th, and realized what was going on. It was late in the morning when we realized what was happening. We decided that day that we was going to try to work things out, which was September 11th. I have a 4-year-old daughter that was born on September 11th. I have a 2-year-old son. Our marriage is going great. I think it was a morale booster for me and my family.
Scotty, that is a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. But I want to ask you a question, Scotty. You had trouble in your marriage, and you patched it up after 9/11. It brought you back together. You made a beautiful child with that. Why haven't we done that as a country? We were having political strain. We pulled together after 9/11, and then we got divided as can be. Do you have any idea why didn't we pull together longer as a country, Scotty?
That is a very good question. And one thing that concerns me is I really feel concerned that people has forgotten what happened to us. And exactly like you said, we're not pulling together. And I'm afraid that if we keep going the route we're going, things may be too late for us as a nation.
We'll take some inspiration from your marriage today, and we love the story, and we thank you for sharing it. Matt in Boston. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to share a very personal story about September 11th. I was 14 and when it happened, and I was home from school that day by chance, and so was my father, and we were watching in horror as the planes hit the buildings in New York. And he was a government worker in Philadelphia, where I'm from, and he said, "Well, I'm off work now. Let's play golf." It was the most bizarre reaction,
yeah.
And I followed along, and obviously there was no one there to bother us, and we kind of kept watch overhead, wondering what the airplanes above were doing, if anything was still going on. And in the car ride home, he broke the news to me that he had terminal cancer. It was a huge shock to me. I had not known. He had been diagnosed when I was barely a baby. And it kind of marked the end of my childhood in a lot of ways. And now, 10 years later, I'm a young reporter. And I realized that I think without that kind of wake-up, with that kind of realization that the world is dangerous and that it matters what we do and what we say and how we involve ourselves, that nothing will ever get any better.
Matt, I'm so glad you're involved as a reporter. We need that. But there, your father, when he said, "Let's go golf," it wasn't frivolous. He had something important to tell you on that day.
Yes, exactly. And it's taken me a while to realize that it was a process for him, that that he was going through something the same way that I was. And he worked in civil service in a way, in the court system. And it made me realize that I could devote my life to something as well that was meaningful and impactful in a lot of ways in his memory. And it demarcated the start, I think, of my adult life. And I think it's an important point for people in my generation who may not know it, but their minds and their thoughts change forever about the world in ways that we may never, ever be able to quantify.
Matt,
I just thought that was an interesting point for the younger generation listening.
I appreciate that so much. And, Matt, you stick with it, and you do not give up. And I appreciate your call. Jack, 14 years old, and I love to hear the nuance coming through in these calls. We were angry. We were afraid. We were suddenly vulnerable. We were enraged. And these 10 years later, at least there's more texture to this. There's more nuance. There's more personal, you know, as soon as you make it real in personal terms, it becomes more deeply real and nuanced.
That's right. And it connects with, it's a moment that connects with lives. And the moment itself doesn't necessarily change things, but it gives our memory a thing to hook onto. I mean, he'll forever, it'll be connected, 9/11, with the memory of his father's passing in that moment on the golf course or the ride home. For earlier callers, the earlier caller from Scotty, it was, mm-hmm. you know, the reconciliation in his marriage and the two lovely children that resulted. For Denise, I think it was, talking about her children that, you know, she didn't think she were going to have any children, had children, despite her fears. So it intersected with memories that people had and sort of framed them up. But it also seemed to have catalyzed decisions, didn't it?
I mean, yeah.
It wasn't just a neutral fact. It was a fact that had some energy in it that changed slightly the direction of lives, and perhaps even more than slightly.
But you pull back from the very personal, and the affairs of state were not about reconciliation. We've lived so much of this decade, as you said right at the top, Jack, at war. Here's March 19th, 2003. President Bush announcing to the country that war with Iraq had begun, the air campaign they called Shock and Awe.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
And that anger and that national vulnerability was taken and was off in new directions. David in Chesapeake, Virginia, thanks for calling. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that day very vividly. I worked for the federal government on the end of Clinton and at the beginning of the Bush administration. And, you know, one of the things that you know, we noticed was there was a huge change, almost an eerie kind of feeling within the intel community and several other agencies within the Bush administration that, you know, gave some of us who were there previously a really bad feeling in our stomach that something was happening, going on, or, you know, undermining. We weren't sure. Several of us left. We just did not want to be a part of whatever was getting ready to go down. And I lived about, you know, I don't know, I could probably hit a golf ball to Dulles Airport. And I saw the plane that hit the Pentagon. I was on the interstate on the causeway there, and I saw the plane flying very low, and I knew at that point there's something not right. And I stopped off at a buddy of mine's house who works for the National Imagery Management Agency, and you know, I said, turn on the television, there's something's not right. And he's like, what? And I said, there's a plane left Dulles, you know, just a second ago, and it's flying really low. And I said, something's not right. And sure enough, you know, here we see the planes hitting, you know, the World Trade Center. And, you know, and I think, you know, at that point, you know, it really changed, I guess, my whole suspicions. It really brought my fears to reality that, you know, something within the government, you know, has failed. You know, all the suspicions that you have about, you know, things going on or undermined it or whatever else, I just felt like, you know, our national security just had failed, and there was a lot of anger. And I think that, you know, when people were brought together at that point, you asked the question earlier, you know, how come that hasn't sustained? And I think it's because of the 911 commission report. You know, a lot of people have some very mixed, hardcore feelings about what really went down, and they're you know, politicians, the people, and the public, and everything. You know, people are battling with that still inside because they really don't feel that they trust what the government has told us. And I think that, you know, now we see, you know, with the financial meltdown and everything else, that, you know, it's almost as if all of the things that maybe they were hiding or haven't told us is starting to take effect on them, and they're having these conflicts within themselves as well.
David, I appreciate your call. Jack, you hear that, you know, loss of faith, confidence, mm-hmm. trust, replaced by fear, suspicion. It was hard to resist that tide, and maybe wrong to resist that tide. There was a lot to be suspicious of. It's hard to get that back as a country.
It feels like it's almost irrecoverable. And, you know, people, the crisis of confidence in government now, which is at an almost all-time low after the summer debt negotiations or standoff, that's been chronic. That's been going on for some time. And the background to it clearly is the sense that, for some people, that we never got the truth about 9/11. I think that's only a tiny minority. But for more, it's the circumstances surrounding the movement into Iraq. Were we told the truth? Did the government know the truth? How could we be so wrong? That's the stuff to create, you know, cankering doubts about whatever the president or the government says.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It is our last show before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. I'm here with On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. We have opened the phone lines. We're looking back on the last 10 years with you on 9/11 and all that came after and where we are now. What have we been through? What have we learned? We heard a lot through those years. Here was October 7th, 2001. U.S. and British forces had started bombing terrorist command centers in Afghanistan. Then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld saying there was going to be a lot more to come, a lot of angles on this.
The fact is, in this battle against terrorism, there is no silver bullet. There is no single thing that is going to suddenly make it that threat disappear.
We had no idea how ugly it would become. In 2004, human rights violations at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, national, global attention. Army Specialist Lindy England was sentenced to prison. In a 2009 interview with the BBC, Lindy England was asked if it was acceptable to strip people naked and degrade them. She didn't back down.
For softening up tactics, if it helps get whatever information they might have. Sure.
Sure. And those images will live with us together forever of those prisoners at Abu Ghraib. And it got worse. This was a rough decade. 2008 financial crisis and recession. The Dow had its largest point drop in decades. September 29th, 2008.
The worst day on Wall Street since the crash of 1987.
Working the phone say a lot of their customers are freaked out waiting to see how low the Dow will go.
It went low, and we're still not out of that trough. And all this in just these 10 years. Beth in Earhart, South Carolina. Beth, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate this opportunity for this conversation today. One of the things that I can say that has definitely been impacted in my life by 9/11 was a core belief that I've held as a Christian my whole life, that I felt as though I could trust my fellow man, give them, you know, think the best of my fellow humans until they prove me definitely wrong. And so this has really shaken this core belief I've held my whole life.
That one day, those two towers coming down, those thousands of lives lost, and out goes your faith?
Well, I wouldn't say my total faith, but my way of looking at my fellow man has been shaken. That everyone has a core, we're all good inside, deep down, really. But the men that did these acts, it shook my faith that they didn't have any sense of a core belief of the value of human life, that they could do this to strangers that they had nothing personally against.
Yeah. And that was deeply shaking, deeply. But then, of course, they say they did have something deeply against. They say they had something big against. And then many other deaths in those years that follow. Beth, I appreciate your call. I mean, what you're saying, Jack, Beth is not the only one. Here's Shane on Facebook. Says, the events of 9/11 placed deep doubts within my being that a caring and loving God exists. And because I have not and cannot seem to rid myself of those doubts, I had no choice but to call myself an atheist. Because on September 10th, I had no doubts in my perception of a personal loving God. He says, if there is a God, he's a lot of much explaining to do, and that's how 9/11 changed me. But here's another, Jack and Beth. This is from Yar in Kentucky, I think. He says, why is the World Trade Center site hallowed ground? I believe it is hallowed not because of the deaths of so many, but because of how they lived on that final day. A community was working together to save lives. That is true. When we focus only on death, hate wins. When we focus on life, love can prevail. I hope on this 10th year of remembrance, we remember the love shared on that day and over this past decade, not the fear or hate. Yar writes, the acts of kindness far outnumber those of hate. We will never be able to count them all. The message, I love you, is the final word. I would wish it so, Jack.
Well, you know, I have a story for Beth that shows the good of people. As you know, my wife and I went down for the first anniversary of 9/11, and we were standing outside the, which was still then the pit, watching the firefighters who had just been honored in their full uniform, regalia, and so on, walking by crowds of people applauding till your hands hurt. And we had been talking with people around us. One man, burly guy, had volunteered and worked on the pile for 10 straight days. He was a metal worker, and he volunteered. He knew what he was doing, and he had worked as he'd gone through a pair of boots there. And there was a woman, just a woman, a young woman who lived in Manhattan. And as the fireman started to go by her, she reached in a bag she had, and it was full of rose petals. And she threw the rose petals at them. And she kept throwing the rose petals at them and saying, thank God for what you did. And just then she broke down and started to just shake with sorrow and remembrance. And this guy who was filming, the burly construction worker who was filming the events, didn't take his eye off the camera, reached out with a powerful arm and held her tight until she stopped. And I thought, there it is. You know, he was up for calming and consoling a woman and for trying to save lives at the pile. And the firemen were there to remember, to remind everyone of the absolute best in human nature.
And within, what, some months, shock and awe, too. Ben in Wilmington, Delaware. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
I just want to remind folks that in reaction to the few thousand deaths that are obviously quite tragic in New York and D.C. and Pennsylvania on 9/11, we have gone on to start endless wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with 100,000+ at least dead, with many poor American soldiers dead and maimed and wounded.
Yes.
And out of our public eye.
And only 1% of us. Only 1% of us.
I'm sorry?
And only 1% of us, Ben, paying that price.
1% of us paying that price, and meanwhile we're going through a large, crazy economic crisis. It's just a bad reaction to violence. It's just not, if we're, if this country is mostly Christian, it's not a Christian maneuver. It's horribly sad, our response to, We could have made a big change. We could have, made a step in the right direction for humankind, and instead, we've been dropping drone bombs on funerals and on, I don't know what else to say. It's quite emotional. I'm very sad about the folks who died on 9/11. Very, very sad. And I'm also very sad for the millions that we've affected around the world.
Ben,
secret prisons,
yeah.
With black ops, with just innumerable amount of war, and with the just the militarization of our country. I just feel it's a bad response.
It's all there, Ben. It's all there. We hear it, and you're not the only one. We've got lots of response on, Michigan writes, I'm still astounded by the disproportional response of the U.S. to mere 19 men with box cutters. Look at what we ourselves have wrought on our country. And yet, that was a blow that day. Rhodes says, we learned to be afraid out of all proportion to the danger, and we gave unscrupulous politicians among us a weapon which they have not hesitated to use against democracy. There is a shared fear with you. Here's another listener. Unfortunately, it seems Bin Laden got what he wanted. The U.S. has spent itself in the name of safety into the ground. All that in that category. Mike in Boston. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Mike. I'm actually, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually surprised I'm on the air. To be honest with you, I think that we've been lied to, and my sadness is that I've lost credibility in the government, and more so, I've lost credibility in the press. You guys aren't questioning anything.
Which lie, Mike? What lie, Mike? What lie? Which lie?
Well, I'll tell you one lie. You know, I have eyes, and when you look at the photograph of Shanksville, there is not a piece of plane there. But we're supposed to believe that an engine of 3 tons of titanium that doesn't melt until 3,600 has disappeared? Or you look at the photographs of...
What do you think happened, Mike? What do you think happened? What do you think happened?
Well, first of all, it was a false flag. Because if you look at...
In other words, you don't think it was Al-Qaeda?
Oh, absolutely not. Look at Building 7. You take a photo, Dan Rather, has, you know, you can look at all these videos. And when that building comes down, it comes down straight. And you, we're expected to believe that five things happened that never happened before and has never happened since. And that is that fire has brought down a steel building. And if you look at the World Trade Centers, they're black smoke. It's incomplete combustion. It's got to be about 600 to 800 degrees over there. That can't melt steel at 2,300.
Mike, we got it. Jack, you hear the deep skepticism there. I mean, skepticism on so many fronts born out of that day, even to the very authors of the deed itself. I mean, Mike is not going to buy the story that's there.
No, and of course, the authors of the deed itself took credit for it. So presumably they were part of the cover-up, too. You know, you're always going to get this kind of wild surmises about things that have... You know, the fact is, reality often doesn't have a lucid explanation. It's full of buildings that aren't supposed to burn that burn. It's full of 12 things that go wrong. That's the nature of events in the world. And people who want to simplify it and find one common thread to sort of hang their doubts on, that's what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics. And luckily, it hasn't caught on around that issue much.
It's a vivid thread. Though Thaddeus calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Thaddeus, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, you know, when September 11th happened, I was a 21-year-old Marine corporal. I was serving in a peacetime military, and that all changed very quickly, as we now know. I've fought in Iraq. I've not been to Afghanistan, and I just want to let the listeners and folks out there know that, you know, our troops are doing good things overseas, and we're helping these people.
And how much longer, Thaddeus, do you think that's going to be the way we need to respond?
Well, I think there is increasingly the public is getting tired of the war, particularly since bin Laden was successfully killed. I think people are saying, when is the end in sight? And these countries have so far to go and are so behind because of the dictators they were under. The idea to having a democratically elected freedom and democracy to them is completely foreign, and it's I think the American public will lose interest before we're completely done with nation building and instilling a democracy.
Thaddeus, we appreciate your service and your call. One more piece of tape right here, May 1st, 2011, this year, late night address. President Obama tells the nation Osama bin Laden was dead, killed by a team of Navy SEALs.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
Jack, we've just got a minute. What ends there and what does not, Jack, in the resonance of this terrible tragedy 10 years ago?
Well, I think one thing that ends was pointed to in a remark of Robert Gates just before he retired. He said that the next time someone comes to an American president and says we have to intervene militarily in the Middle East, he's going to say you ought to have your head examined.
Secretary of Defense.
That's from the Secretary of Defense. I really think that is a legacy, not just the issue of the money and so on, but just the sense that this is, and also the current of change that's happening without us in the Arab world. The Arab Spring suggesting that even Iraq could have changed. Even Iraq almost undoubtedly would have felt shockwaves from this. And that we don't need to install democracy with a bayonet. It can come out of the desires and the sacrifices of very brave people today all across the Arab world.
10 years later, and all that history, we only managed to touch a bit of it. Listeners, thank you for your calls. One of our guests this week saying that she decided not to move on, but to move forward. And I am all for that. Jack, thank you very much for all these years and for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, newly released 9/11 recordings 10 years after. This is On Point. A newly released collection of 114 audio tapes from the morning of 9/11 has come into public with the attack's 10th anniversary. It was compiled for the government's September 11th commission and only now made fully available with the sound of a nation first taking on board what had happened. We share this excerpt with you now from that morning.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
Buddy, we have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're returning to the airport. 15,000
put the phone up on the Hampton
climate. And who's trying to call me here?
Project Weapon, Sergeant Powell.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Kennedy Tower reports, are you serious? Kennedy Tower reports that there was a fire at the World Trade Center. And that's the area where we lost the airplane.
We have several situations going on here. It's escalating big time. And we need to get the military involved with this.
Wow, what's going on?
Just get me somebody who has the authority to get military in here now.
All right.
You see, guy, look, is he descending for the building also?
He's descending really quick, too, yeah.
Well, that's
2,500 feet now. He just dropped 800 feet in like one sweep.
That's another situation. What kind of airplane is that? Can you guys tell?
I don't know. I'll read it out in a minute.
Another one just hit the building.
Wow.
Another one just hit it hard.
Another one just hit the World Trade.
The whole building just came apart.
Oh, holy smokes.
American Dispatch, Jim McDonald.
Indianapolis Center, did you get a hold of American 77 by chance?
No, sir, but we have an unconfirmed report that the second airplane hit the World Trade Center.
Say again?
You know, we lost American 11 through a hijacking. So.
You got United 93?
United 93.
South of Chardonnay,
yeah.
It descended.
What's okay. That?
I just saying, it looked like he descended there.
I don't think so. United 93, verify 350.
United 93, Cleveland.
Go ahead, Franklin.
Do you have United 93 south of Chardonnay?
We hear some funny noises. We're trying to get him. Do you have him?
No.
Go for 86, thank you. Descend and maintain 2000.
Okay, we're down to 2000. This is go for 06. It looks like that aircraft crashed into the Pentagon, sir.
Go for 86. Go for 06, thank you.
Go ahead.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land? Because we have information.
He did not land.
Oh, he's down?
Yes,
down?
Somewhere up northeast of Camp David.
Northeast of Camp David.
That's the last report. They don't know exactly where.
And that was it. 10:14 a.m. September 11th, 2001. The Federal Aviation Administration's Washington Center there finally telling NORAD's Northeast Defense Sector that United Flight 93 had crashed 11 minutes after it went down there. For a full transcript and to listen back to all the archived recordings of that morning, September 11th, 2001, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for being with us today and in all these years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.